Up next on Boston Public Radio, the House votes unanimously to restore a payment to the families of dead soldiers. Should they be applauded or condemned? Then the Supreme Court is back with Citizens United, the sequel, and abortion buffer zones in Massachusetts on the docket. We'll examine what's at stake. Then, what the Pats quarterback told a WGBH reporter about concussions. Is Tom Terrific setting a bad example for kids?
Christopher Lydon joins us with his rapturous interpretation of the new hit movie Gravity. Karen Miller on today's big tech confab at MIT. And then, Americans' obsession with refrigeration. Do you refrigerate that mayonnaise or not? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. And you're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hello there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So you know the government shutdown has succeeded in locking the people out when the U.S. Senate chaplain is compelled to chastise Congress by saying this yesterday.
Lord, when our federal shutdown delays payments of death benefits to the families of children dying on faraway battlefields. It's time for our lawmakers to say enough is enough.
Amen, Chaplain Barry Black. He's praying for political unity. And by the way, you know this. Following his prayer, the House voted unanimously, I think it was 425-0, to restore those benefits, $100,000 per family. There's no action in the Senate yet. And we want to know at 877-301-8970, is this vote a sign that Congress has compassion and gets it? Or does this illustrate how utterly tone-deaf Congress is? Let me give you the answer of one person, Marjorie. This is one of the most chilling quotes I've ever heard. One of the 26 members of the military who's died since the beginning of the shutdown, six in combat, 20 not, is Private First Class Cody Patterson. He was 24 years old. He's from Oregon. His father's name is Randall Patterson. Listen to what his father had to say in response to the fact that the death benefit didn't exist as the father prepared to see his son's body returned to Delaware. By the way, this is reported by NBC News. If Congress were trapped in a car that sunk down in a river, I would swim to the window and I would look them all in the eye and say, suck water. And I'll tell you, if anybody captured the essence and the cruelty, and in my opinion, and the thoughtlessness of this Congress, it is unbelievable. You know, their line yesterday was, I don't know if you follow this as closely as I couldn't take my eyes off the screen. They were doing, you remember Captain Renault from Casablanca?
Yes.
I'm shocked that gambling has gone in here. Well, they were all shocked that the death benefit disappeared. $100,000 a family. And thank goodness for the Fisher House, which is a non-governmental entity.
Great.
Provides help to families who can visit their injured family member who was injured in combat or that sort of thing.
One in West Roxbury.
That's right. A relatively new one here in West Roxbury. And by the way, they're fronting the $100,000 and the Pentagon is going to pay them back. Good for them. But all these members, the Republicans were trashing the Attorney General for his interpretation of the law, saying they thought it was covered. The Democrats were in an orgy of self-congratulations for the vote. And it turns out, again, thanks to to NBC News, that the Undersecretary of Defense on September 27th,
three days
before the shutdown, said these words. We would also be required, if there's a shutdown, to do some other bad things to our people. Just some examples, he said. We couldn't immediately pay death gratuities, that's the term of art for this, to those who die on active duty during the lapse.
Right,
so
up,
they knew.
Well, he was right up there at the podium saying these things. Well, you assume that they knew. Frankly, I didn't know. I figured that they were including these along with the payment to members of the military, but
which they did vote on, and which
yes,
the president did sign. The
but I think it's I don't think anybody believes most of these congresspeople for a minute. I think you saw them all congratulating each other, and you think what happened is they were sort of caught.
Exactly.
You had the chaplain get up there and say how disgraceful this was not to pay these death benefits, and the news media get on top of it. And I think that they were embarrassed. So what do you guys make of this? Do you think that they just are self-congratulatory because they got caught in taking away this benefit, or do you think this is sincere? I don't think anybody thinks these people are sincere anymore, but maybe there's one person that does think they're sincere. Our number is 877-301-8970. Everybody was sort of voicing outrage over this. You know, the lawmakers in the White House as well. So it was across
the board. But the outrage is tempered with criticism of the other party. The criticism should be in the mirror to themselves for being so out of touch and so clueless, to use your word, that they're ultimately caught for this transgression. And then again, say, well, I mean, yesterday, one of the chief Republicans in the House, not one of the two leaders, but the chair of some Republican congressional group, is saying, Attorney General Holder, how dare he? We were under the impression when we restored military pay and when the president signed it, it included death benefits. Well, the Undersecretary of Defense said it didn't include this. And wouldn't the irony be that it had to be the bodies and the deaths of 26 relatively young people in this country?
Oh, you see their pictures. They're very young. I mean, it's just one of them is a woman. Not that that should matter. I mean, it's just a tragic for the young men. But you see the pictures of these four young people. At least three of them look like they're in their 20s. Maybe one of them is a little bit older, but they just...
Four of 26. Six died in Afghanistan, 20 in accidents and other things around the world. Let me read that quote one more time before we start again. Private First Class Cody Patterson, who is 24 years old. Here's what his father had to say. Cody Patterson, father, as his father waited to see his son's body return to Delaware, quote, if Congress were trapped in a car that sunk down in a river, I would swim to the window, he said. I would look them all in the eye and say, suck water. I mean, I think he speaks for virtually every Republican and Democratic and independent American after, 10 days of this abomination.
877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. I think that it's just another bit of just horribly depressing and discouraging news about what goes on in Washington, D.C. It just makes you very worried about the future.
By the way, CNN is now reporting that the House is going to offer some temporary debt deal that would extend the debt ceiling from the 17th of October, the deadline, for maybe 6 weeks, during which time they negotiate. The only good news that's happened in the last 24 hours, I'm sure you all know this, Eric Cantor, the number two Republican in the House, and Paul Ryan, the former Republican vice presidential nominee of Mitt Romney. Ryan wrote in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, Cantor wrote, I think, in the Washington Post, an op-ed in which they say what it would take to settle this deal. Neither of them mentioned one word, and the one word was Obamacare. So obviously that's off the table,
and by
even
the way,
if they won't admit it.
Before we get to the calls, just in case people don't know, Fisher House, what they do is they, when soldiers are very, very wounded, they have a little, like a Ronald McDonald House, basically, for the families of the wounded, because some of these people are there for, you know, 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, and it enables the wives, girlfriends, kids, if they're young enough to come and live there.
Travel and stay.
Yes. And of course, if you were trying to be there and stay in a hotel, you couldn't afford it. And it also gives great solidarity to the partners of the wounded soldiers, because they're in the same boat and they can cook dinners together in the Fisher House and they can commiserate with each other. So it's a wonderful organization. And it's great that we have one here in Boston. So let's go to the calls. Kevin on Cape Cod. Hi, Kevin.
How are you?
Hey.
Depressed.
Aren't we all?
Yeah.
There's a soundbite out there, I don't know if you've heard this, of a senator who's complaining that although the Senate gym is open, that there are no attendees in the gym, and that although they pay a fee for towel service, they're forced to launder their own towels.
I have to say I missed it.
Oh, God.
It's just egregiously wrong.
Why is the gym, you know, I'd heard that the gym was open, and I actually heard Republicans and Democrats who serve in Congress saying that it was unthinkable. Why, do you know, Kevin, why is it still open? Why isn't that shut down?
Because it's for them.
Well, so that is the unfortunate truth. Kevin, I'm sorry.
I have a solution.
What is it?
Anti the eye. On every ballot for the next 4 years, if the person has an eye, or incumbent next to their name, vote who's ever running against them.
Well, you know, a variation on this theme, there was a guy from Cape Cod, and I can't remember his name. I interviewed him a few years ago, who had another alternative, which was to add to the Massachusetts ballot. It wouldn't be on federal offices because we don't have the power to do it, because he was going to do a ballot question here. None of the above. So that essentially you don't have to pick what you might consider to be the lesser of two evils, if that's what you consider the choices to be, but say, I reject both of them. And I believe his proposed law, his bill and his ballot question would have said if none of the above got a majority, then no one was elected to the office, which, as far as I'm concerned, in this environment, would be a wonderful outcome. Kevin, thank you for the call.
By the way, Kevin is absolutely right. I just looked it up. He's a Democratic congressman, Bruce Bailey. He's from Iowa, and he did complain about the towel service.
What, that there was no service in the gym? Is that what he's saying, really, in the congressional gym?
I have to read it more closely to find out what exactly he did say, but I'm looking at it right now, and I'll get back to you.
Well, let me take a call while you're taking a look at it. Michael, you're in Roxbury, and you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Welcome and thank you.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
First of all, the beginning of all of this was allegedly because people did not want Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have the governor of the great state of Kentucky saying, I'm implementing Obamacare in my state. I'm running through my state. This is a great thing for the people of my state who are many individuals are underserved with regard to health care, and the two senators from that state want to kill Obamacare. Mm. So this is the insanity of the beginning of all of it.
And that's Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul, by the way, for those who don't know, but go ahead.
Two other great Americans, I'm sure. So then the entire government is shut down, and piecemeal, it's a tragedy to do this or a tragedy to do that. Really, all Americans are equal, and it's all a tragedy.
So you're saying the fact that they're singling out these death benefits suggests that other things are not quite as important. Is that where you're going with this, Michael?
Oh, well, yes, and you know, there's apparently a pecking order. I have no problem with the fact. I mean, the fact that they shut down the government, so the families of members of the military do not get this money, and they knew that before they shut the government down. The whole thing is a tragedy, but what's worse is it creates a pecking order. These people are more important. The families of these people are more important than these people. The kids who don't get to go to Head Start, I think they're pretty important too. I think they're really important, and all of them are equally important is all I'm saying.
Michael, thank you for a thoughtful call. We appreciate it.
Okay, you want the quote from the congressman?
Oh, yeah. By the way, our number is 877-301-8970. We're asking your reaction to the 425-to-zip a vote in the House of Representatives yesterday to restore the death gratuity, as it's called, for members of the military who died since the October 1st shutdown. There are 26 of them. Yeah, what did he say?
During a radio interview yesterday, the Iowa Congressman Braley, who's running for U.S. Senate, this may hurt his efforts, I'm not sure. He scoffed at a bill by two Democratic congressmen who don't want employees at the U.S. House gym considered essential during the shutdown. Quote, I find it ironic that there's this big push to shut down the House gym when it's one of the rare places people come together and talk about how we can build relationships. There's hardly anybody working down there, and there's no towel service, so we're doing our own laundry, and we pay a fee to belong to the House gym.
Can you believe somebody that's stupid?
I don't know.
I'm serious. Even if you believe it, is dumb enough to say this, is an elected representative of one of 435 in the House of Representatives. I'm very glad, Kevin, that caller brought that to our attention. 877-301-8970. The only hopeful thing out of this, in my estimation, is this may be what pushes it over the edge. Not that the death benefit was denied. It's still denied, technically, were it not for the independent, non-governmental Fisher House, but that they have to be humiliated by this abomination. Let's go to where, Marjorie?
Dan in the car. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Dan.
Hi, guys. Really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I am very frustrated to continually hear when this story is reported that everyone is disgusted with Congress, because this is one party strategy, and it's been in place and planned for months. The Republican majority in the House refused a conference on the Senate budget. They are currently obeying their own convention about whether to bring bills to the floor, this Hastert rule that requires, in order for the Speaker to clear a bill, House floor. A majority of his own party must favor it.
And by the way, Hastert is a former Speaker of the House, for those who don't know, I think from Illinois, if I remember correctly, yeah.
And if you read the proposals that have been made or the conditions that have been set, they have essentially been putting in front of the American people, we'll continue to fund programs we've already authorized if you'll reverse the last election.
Yeah, but Dan, let me temper one thing you say. And by the way, they're paying a price. I'm sure you saw the poll that came out this morning that has the Republican Party at 27% approval, the lowest since Gallup started asking that question, I think in 1992. But here's the flip side, I think. I would have agreed with you until yesterday. And the reason I'm changing my opinion a little bit is now that, even though they won't admit it, Obamacare is off the table, as evidenced by the two op-eds by Eric Cantor and by Paul Ryan. And the words that I believe Ryan used, and I'm paraphrasing, were we need modest entitlement reform. Well, if that's what they want, and President Obama was in the last negotiation on the debt ceiling in 2011 willing to negotiate $1 trillion in cuts, why isn't he willing to seize on that and say, now that Obamacare is off the table, let's cut a deal on entitlement reform? Because frankly, I'm willing to do it, he said repeatedly, and get this thing over with. It's really his move, isn't it?
Well, in a way it is. But if you look at what has just been proposed, and it's rather cynical, and I'll come back to your election point if you give me enough time. In a
second. Sure, go ahead.
It's rather cynical. What they've proposed, just proposed before your show started, is we'll lift the debt ceiling for 6 weeks, but we won't reopen the government.
Mm.
And that's, if you want to talk about cynicism, we'll make sure that our rich patrons are paid, and we'll continue to value uphold the value of their stocks, but we won't let the government operate.
Yeah, but I think, Dan, the one thing where I think the president is completely supported, I'm separating the debt ceiling from the shutdown, I think his position is that nothing happens, no deals on anything until the government is reopened. And then if you want to negotiate, I would suggest entitlement reform, because, again, he's proposed a means testing of Medicare. He's proposed a lower inflation rate on Social Security, the so-called chain CPI. Do that as part of the debt deal, and then both parties can maybe shake hands quickly, Dan.
If you'll give me – I know it has to be quick.
Yeah.
But 2 points are, number one, if this happens, if this deal happens based on this negotiating principle, this will become the principle of modern government, where we continue to shut down government periodically to get what we want.
Well, I think that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, Scott is one of the emailers, is absolutely with Dan, who says, don't lay this on the blame of anybody else but the Tea Party and the Republican Party.
Well, at the beginning of this and this shutdown strategy that Dan just mentioned is at the feet of the Tea Party, and they are paying a price. I don't know how long it's going to last, but to have the lowest numbers since polling began on either party in Congress.
What's upsetting is they're not going to pay a price in their home districts, and that's what's really upsetting. So they could be reelected indefinitely, and of course people like you don't want to have any term limits, so they could be here for another 50 years.
Well, except for the fact that what are the numbers, and I don't have them off the top of my head, I think it's 235 to 200 in the House. I think I'm right, which means there need to be 18. If I'm off, I'm off by one or two. That means there only need 18 seats to change parties. You're right about what's that called? Gerrymandering of districts for the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats. 18 is not a huge turnover if the people are really angry a year and a month from now. And the Senate, it could be a strong enough majority to get, assuming the Democrats benefit from this, that they don't have to worry about that 60-vote threshold anymore. What are they, 50-something, 55?
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that it's more likely that if another Republican presidential nominee gets totally trounced because people are sick of these antics, that may be a much more effective.
It's 3 years away.
It is 3 years away. But you know, I just think if you go back on the weekends and you talk to your constituents and they're cheering you on and saying, don't give in, this is why we sent you. I mean, I'm just not hopeful that it's going to change.
Let's take one more.
Drew from Newport. Hi, Drew.
Hi, Drew.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just thinking, they just keep doing this stuff over and over again, and it's time to just get rid of all of them. Democrat, Republican, Independent, Tea Party, just throw them all out. Let's start with some new people that will actually do the job that they're sent there to do.
Well, we had a Democrat and a Republican here the other day, Shannon O'Brien and Charlie Chipio, and I asked them if it was legally permissible for there to be a national referendum, a la what you're suggesting, where people could vote to replace the whole Congress. They couldn't protect their own. I think Shannon said she thought it'd be 70% approval. Yeah. And I think Charlie said, and I think it'd be 95% approval. So, Drew, in the current mess, I am with you. You know what we should end the segment with?
What we began it with,
because it was so beautifully done. Let's hear the Senate chaplain, Barry Black. We'll get him in a second. This is him yesterday. Remember, this is an employee of the Senate.
Yeah, because standing he's up so mortified and embarrassed.
Like the American people.
Exactly. I mean, it is mortifying and embarrassing.
Lord, when our federal shutdown delays payments of death benefits to the families of children dying on faraway battlefields, it's time for our lawmakers to say enough is enough.
Well, good for Chaplain Barry Black.
Speaks for everybody, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. When we come back, we're going to look at the Supreme Court's new season. According to Vanity Fair magazine, this season of is reality TV. Like, we need to DVR the season. That conversation with Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
What does it mean, do you suppose, to be able to use a bank if you've never been able to before?
We see that our participants increase their credit scores by on average like 168 points. What they now have is access to low-cost loans in the financial marketplace through banks, credit unions, other microlenders.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. New lending programs for New Economic Times next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And SNH Construction, specializing in residential renovations, custom building, historic restorations, renewable energy, site work solutions, and remodeling. SNH, quality, integrity, and value. shconstruction.com. And This Old House, Jersey Shore Rebuilds. Follow the restoration of three Jersey Shore houses damaged by Superstorm Sandy. This special season of This Old House continues Thursday at 8 on WGBX 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. As you know, the Supreme Court starts its new session this week. Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers joins us to preview this season's docket and review how the High Court's ruling on the Affordable Care Act in the last session is playing out now that people are signing up for Obamacare. Renee Landers, great to see you again.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Before we get to what's coming up, and it is pretty exciting stuff. I mean, they've got prayer, they've got abortion, they've got affirmative action, they've got tons of very visceral things. I didn't know this until a couple of weeks ago, but the so-called Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, is going to leave out two-thirds of poor African-Americans and single mothers and more than half of the low-wage workers who don't have insurance because of this gap in the states that have not agreed to expand Medicaid.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
I mean, how can this stand? I just find this unbelievable.
So, you know, in a different time, you know, gaps like this sometimes are written into the legislation, and there's another one that's relevant to the Medicaid piece as well, but and the exchanges. But gaps occur in legislation, or they're created by this kind of unexpected court decision. And at a different time, you know, Congress would go back and fix it. But obviously, this Congress is not inclined to do anything to improve the Affordable Care Act statute, and so that's not going to happen. And I think that part of the structure of the statute was to try to provide an incentive for states to adopt the Medicare expansion so that they would cover more of their low-income populations. But with the state's ability to reject the expansion, then
which the Supreme Court decided when they ruled on Obamacare.
That's right. They don't have to do that.
Yeah. So is that it?
Well, yes. So, and the issue is that there's a gap because many states don't cover populations up to 100% of the poverty level. And so people but those people can be covered. And so those people below the 100% of poverty level and, say, 50% that the state might cover, they're prohibited from purchasing insurance on the exchanges.
So it's like another donut hole.
Exactly.
It's really this donut hole for this.
By the way,
before you go ahead, I want to fill in these blanks here. Because the Supreme Court allowed states to choose whether to expand Medicaid, as you and Renee have been discussing, 26 states, according to the New York Times, have rejected the Medicaid expansion. That is home to about half the country's population. But here's the kicker. It's also home to about 68% of poor, uninsured blacks and single mothers. So the people who arguably need the coverage the most and can afford it the least are the ones who are paying the price of this provision in the Supreme Court's decision, correct?
Correct. That's correct.
But I guess what I'm asking, is there a remedy for this? Is this something that someone can bring in a different case before the
Yeah, I can answer that. The Congress is going to come back into session today, open the government, and fix the problem.
I'm serious, though.
No. I mean, that's one fix. And the other fix is for these states to adopt the Medicaid expansion. And so, you know, you take the states like Virginia and Maryland right next to each other. You know, Maryland, this problem will not exist. There won't be any gaps, big gaps like this in the coverage created by the Supreme Court decision. And Virginia, the gap will exist. So people can look across the border of the states and see the result of the state decision about adopting the Medicaid expansion.
So the celebration that was heard throughout the land by those who support universal health care when the decision came down should have been tempered a little bit had they foreseen what states were likely to do.
Yes, I think so, because I think that the number of states that have rejected the expansion or had declined to adopt the expansion, I think was unanticipated.
Okay, let's go to this next session.
That's swell.
One of the few Supreme Court decisions other than the Affordable Care Act decision where I think at least a significant percentage of Americans could actually remember the name is Citizens United.
Right.
They may not know exactly what it is, but before you tell us about Citizens United, the sequel, as I will call it, I know it's not called that, tell people briefly, what did Citizens United do in, was it 2010, 2011, I guess it was?
Right.
What did the Supreme Court do that has gotten so many money and politics people crazy?
Well, the first thing it did was it sort of ruled that corporations should be treated as people are treated under
the
campaign
finance law. And unions, by the way, in all fairness.
Right, exactly. Yeah, corporations, any organization should be treated just like an individual under the campaign finance laws, and therefore said that expenditure limits by these organizations were not constitutional under the campaign finance laws. And so what it's done is it's allowed organizations, not in coordination with candidate campaign committees, but to spend unlimited amounts to advocate for particular candidates.
Well, you know, the whole notion about the separation, first of all, and that has allowed some billionaires, as we all remember, frankly, on both sides, I think more Republican than Democratic, to give tens of millions of dollars to their candidates through these PACs.
Correct.
You know, the notion, the argument was, well, at least they're separate. During the primary season, I was interviewing a former staff person for Newt Gingrich, who had moved over to become head of his PAC. And as you say, technically by law, they need to be separate. And without thinking, I said to him, I said, hey, we've been trying to get Newt Gingrich on the show. When you talk to him next, and I was joking, can you ask him to come on? And he said, I'm going to see him right after the show.
Right.
I will, of course, ask him. And so I didn't think about it till my producer said afterwards, there's supposed to be a separation between these independent expenditure committees, which he was heading, and the candidate's campaign. And the guy who runs it was going out for a drink with Gingrich right afterwards, which sort of belies the whole notion there's a separation to begin with.
Yeah. No, it's sort of hard to believe that there is, on both sides,
there's
not coordination.
So
strategy.
What's part two, which I find to be even more upsetting potentially, this McCutcheon versus Federal Election Committee Commission case, which they agreed to take. What's that do?
All right. So that would, the allegation there is this that there are individual, limits on what individuals can give to candidate campaign committees. But there's also an aggregate limit on the amount that a total amount an individual can give give to candidate campaign committees. And McCutcheon is challenging that aggregate limit, saying that a person ought to be able to give the maximum amount under the campaign finance laws to as many candidates as he or she wishes.
And why, by the way, why don't you say what the limit is that this guy says violates his First Amendment rights?
It's like $48,000.
No, it is not. It's $123,000 is not enough. These are individuals. So this, so now that, that corporations and unions are theoretically have First Amendment rights of free speech, which the court has decided they can spend whatever they want, in theory, if McCutcheon, this Alabama business guy, wins this case, then individuals essentially have no aggregate limits anymore either.
That's correct. I mean, they still have a limit on what they can give to an individual
right.
candidate, but they can give to as many candidates as they want that maximum amount.
Now, obviously, there's been a lot of complaining about Citizens United during the last presidential race, and a lot of people are think this is just, you know, drowning political races in money. But it looks, just from what I've read of the justices, that they may go along with this McCutcheon thing, and there may be what's going to happen? I guess I asked you what's going to happen.
I think that that's a likely result. I think that there are people who think that there are no principled ways to draw lines in applying the First Amendment and limiting speech. But of course, they're assuming that spending money should be equated with speech, which I think that that's the fallacy of that argument.
But that's a central point of their ruling, is have free speech. And I would argue, if I were an open-minded person on this, is if unions and corporations have First Amendment protections to spend whatever they want, how could they possibly rule that individuals don't have similar First Amendment protections to spend whatever they want?
Right, and then we'd be right back into the pre-Watergate phase where these limits did not exist.
That's
hard. Can we move on to one closer to home?
Sure.
The court has two cases about abortion, and one of them is McCullen versus Coakley, as in Martha Coakley. It's a challenge to the Massachusetts law restricting protests near reproductive health facilities, the so-called buffer zone law, where you have to be a certain number of feet away from the clinic with your signs and your pamphlets and all that. The stories I'm reading are saying that this is probably going to be overruled. Do you think so?
I'm not sure what I think, because the court would have to overrule a prior precedent where it upheld the predecessor to this Massachusetts buffer zone statute. And I think the issue here is, I think it's very clear that there is probably a majority of the court that is not in favor of abortion rights.
Right.
And thinks that those, you know, exceed the court's ability under the Constitution to have created these rights. But the law right now is that there is a right to have an abortion. And the question is, how do you balance this right to have an abortion, to exercise that right against the right of speech to try to persuade people of, you know, different views? And, you know, I think that in the earlier case, the court thought that the buffer zone statute struck the right balance. You know, the person entering the abortion clinic can see the signs, can hear at a distance what people are saying, but they don't feel sort of physically intimidated about going into the abortion clinic. And I should say here that I am on the board of Planned Parenthood of Massachusetts, so I'm not entirely dispassionate. But if you are a First Amendment absolutist, then this restriction on speech in a public space would, under that theory, the Constitution would violate
35 feet, right?
Yeah, 35 feet.
You should say where this started, because you covered the killings that led to the buffer zones to begin with.
The John Salvey shootings at the two clinics in Brookline preterm, and down by Cleveland Circle, and the Planned Parenthood closer down to Fenway Park, and both on Beacon Street. But you know, going even Planned Parenthood now, which is on Commonwealth Avenue, on a Saturday, it is a very intimidating, I think, place for a young woman to be going into, because there are quite a few protesters on the street, and they really do have a phalanx. These volunteers are great that go out to escort these young women in, but it's a very people are shouting and calling at you, and it's too bad they can't get them in the back door. But now, of course, they have a metal detector.
Right. The security is the security is quite impressive there. But you know, for the reasons that you've stated, but I think that it's really whether the court is going to see that whether this law strikes an appropriate balance between the ability to exercise these rights.
But if they said 35 feet, which is I think the law in Massachusetts,
right, yes,
violates people's right to picket or whatever it is, would they then say 12 feet is okay? No feet? They wouldn't establish anything, would say as long as there is safety for the woman involved or the family involved? What would the alternative ruling be?
Well, so one of the alternatives here is that, you know, as you mentioned, Marjorie, that people from the clinic, employees in the clinic, can escort the patients into the clinic.
But Supreme Court's not going to say that. I mean, they're not going to say as long as they have an escort, or are they?
No. I think what they're going to say is that you can't prohibit the speech by the anti-choice people.
Oh, because
and allow the speech and allow that the other people to approach. So perhaps they will strike down the provision of the law that allows the presence of the escorts.
I cannot believe that you have a board member of Planned Parenthood in the room and you have not advanced what you have written about 42 times.
Well, what I think is a real tragedy is that women have to go to freestanding clinics in the first place. Mm-hmm. For my money, we should be doing abortions at Brigham and Women's and Beth Israel. We are. But as you know, a lot of the women that go to clinics, they're young. A lot of them don't have insurance. There wouldn't be these protests in the lobby of Brigham and Women. And I just can't imagine men going to freestanding clinics to have to deal with some sort of prostate problem. You know, I know the argument's the other side, that the expertise and all that, but that you have to do a medical procedure in a freestanding clinic as a woman just drives me nuts.
Well, I mean, but I think part of that is that, you know, some of the opposition to abortion has intimidated some of the more mainstream providers from sort of focusing on that.
And we let them get away with it.
Right. And then the other thing that's going on, and I think that we'll probably see some of these cases at the court too, if not this term, next year, a lot of states have been increasingly passing restrictions on or additional regulations on freestanding clinics, you know, about the kinds of relationships they have to have with hospitals, the kinds of equipment they have to have, the kinds of other facilities they have to be able to offer. And it's overall making it, economically infeasible in some states to continue operating these clinics, are very difficult.
Now, Renee Landers, the third case on our list on the Supreme Court's docket, and it's perfect in the spirit of Senate Chaplain Barry Black,
who
we just played.
Yes.
There is a prayer case. What is the case, and what's the issue before the court?
All right. So the issue before the court is it's the case of the Town of Greece against Galloway, and the issue before the court is. Whether, first of all, you know, one issue that's always underlying these cases is whether it's appropriate for these public legislative bodies to be opening their sessions with a prayer. And then second, if they do, do the prayers have to be non-sectarian? Or is it enough to, you know, have a Muslim prayer one day, a Jewish prayer the next day, a Christian prayer the third day, you know, a Hindu prayer some other day? So it's...
Is there precedent here in the Supreme Court?
Yes,
there
is. Yeah, the court in 1983, in a case called Marsh against Chambers, recognized that the practice of opening sessions with prayers, public meetings with prayers, did not violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
So why are they taking this case? What's changed enough that – I mean, this is not a court which you think would want to overrule – that precedent. So why did they take it? Why did the Supreme Court take this case?
Perhaps to reinforce the precedent. To you know, kind of update it and give it, you know, a sort of a refreshing, you know, push.
Does the Supreme Court open with a prayer every session?
Well, no.
It does not.
And
Antonin Scalia sings a little song.
Right. No. But I think also that, you know, I guess it could be, you know, for the First Amendment absolutists, right? Again, if you're really absolutist about the First Amendment, perhaps you would say that prayer does not belong in public meetings. And there are some politicians and others on the conservative side of the spectrum who actually recognize that that perhaps, you know, having this practice of, you know, kind of publicly endorsing, mm-hmm. I put it using endorsing in quotes, religion is perhaps not the way to conduct public life. And these tend to be people who are members of numerical minority religions like Mormons and so forth. I mean, Orrin Hatch, he's always sort of gotten it that, you know, if there was going to be a public religion, it probably wasn't going to be Mormonism just on the numbers. And so, and you know, that made him think about, well, how do other people feel, you know, when there's prayer at these public meetings?
Yeah, do we have time for one last quick
one?
I just wonder whether you think that the Supreme Court will hear this case. Contraception was much discussed during the last presidential election as well, and the Supreme Court has to decide whether they're going to hear a new challenge to Obamacare involving the law's requirement that employers provide insurance coverage for contraception. Do you think – what do you think is going to happen there?
Well, I think they probably will take one of these cases. There is a split in the circuits now with some upholding the regulations and some not. And the issue there is not just a constitutional question, but it's also a statute involved, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which actually requires the government prohibits the government from substantially burdening the free exercise of religion unless there is a requirement in furtherance of a compelling governmental interest, and it's the least restrictive means to do that. And so the argument here on the other side and to uphold the regulation is that the First Amendment doesn't really prohibit a neutral law of general application. And so there are a lot of different organizations who have different views about this. That one set of organizations are, you know, your standard business for-profit corporation, where the owners assert that they have religious beliefs that would be violated by having to offer religious contraceptive coverage. And then there are organizations like, you know, religiously affiliated hospitals and universities who also argue, you know, that they have a religious mission. And then there's the third category, the strictly religious, the church, the synagogue, the house of worship. And the house of worship organizations have been exempted from this requirement, recognizing that that's sort of directly, you know, that's their mission,
right?
To promote the religion and the beliefs of the mission. The organizations in the middle, there's kind of a little compromise in the law that doesn't require them to offer and pay for the contraceptive coverage, but there must be kind of an out where the employees can seek it as, you know, under the umbrella of their general insurance coverage anyway. And those organizations are not happy with that compromise.
You know, before you go,
this is going to be a great season.
It is.
A lot of fights.
Every presidential election cycle, not just I, but lots of people say one of the great outrages, ironies, the single most important thing that I think a president does, some say it's declare war or not, I would say is appoint justices to the Supreme Court. If there was ever a perfect juxtaposition, Congress is totally shut down. You're listing for us a bunch of things that nine men and women are going to decide in the next year.
That are big deals.
Which will have impacts on virtually every American for decades.
Right.
For decades. And the men and women sit there because a Republican or a Democrat elected by the people gets to choose them when one dies or retires. And it is stunning to me that it never creeps its way to the top of the list of issues that, I mean, sometimes single issue people occasionally are there. But essentially, Supreme Court appointments, particularly when they're old justices, is huge. And the impact goes well beyond an Obama, a Bush, a Clinton, or whatever.
Right. And it rarely registers as an issue that the public is concerned about during an election campaign. And one of the other cases that the court's going to decide is the NLRB against Noel Canning case, which actually sort of directly goes to this interplay among all three of the branches.
That's the recess
appointments case, where the Constitution says, I'm going to paraphrase here, but the exact language is actually kind of important, that the president may fill appointments during a recess as they have, that may happen during a recess.
When Congress is in recess.
Congress is in recess. And so this issue came up because the president used that power to fill some seats on the NLRB, and then those appointments were challenged, and the validity of the National Labor Relations Board decisions were challenged. Subsequently, you know, Congress and the president have been able to agree, and the Senate has confirmed a full panoply of members to the National Labor Relations Board for the first time in 10 years. And also confirmed the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was another issue under the recess appointments clause. And so the question there is, one is, you know, does the president have the power to use it to fill these vacancies for vacancies only that arise when the Senate
is in recess?
Or can he fill a vacancy that has pre-existed the recess? And then, you know, and so that's one major issue. And then the other question is, you know, who gets to decide when the Senate is in recess? You know, is it the president or the Congress?
And for those who don't know, right. Republicans make as many recess appointments as Democrats. And this is not a partisan issue. It's what presidents do.
Right. It's what they've done, increasingly done, as the, you know, the politics have gotten more difficult about the appointments process. So I think a lot of these issues have to do with that the court is going to be considering really reflects some failures of politics, right? The failures of the Congress and the president and the Senate, particularly, to agree on appointments to keep government agencies running. And a lot of this litigation about the Affordable Care Act reflects that same issue. And I think and I hope that the Supreme Court will say, you know what, you worked it out on the NLRB and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Maybe it was under the duress of this pending case in the Supreme Court. But maybe that's what the court ought to do, that, you know, say, is that we can't, you know, referee these disputes between the political branches, and you have to work them out yourselves.
Does the court have the constitutional power to just dissolve the Congress? Can they do that on petition of a citizen or a radio talk show? Renee Landers, thank you as always.
Thank you for explaining all this, Renee. It was great. Renee Landers is professor of law and at Suffolk University. And again, thank you very much for taking the time to come in with us today.
Thank you, Renee. Thanks.
When we come back, we're going to go to something, well, it's serious, but it's sports related. Tom Brady's claim that when it comes to his job, he's not too worried about occupational hazards, including concussions. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
I'm David Bernstein. I'm a contributing analyst for WGBH News. I live here and I work here. Local reporting and analysis, especially on politics, is really important to people because they get so much of it nationally. But they really don't get enough sometimes at the local level of who is doing what with their money and their policies, connecting what politicians do to everybody's lives. David Bernstein, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Castle Group, PR, digital media, and events partner to businesses that value local connections, international reach, and marketing intelligence, connecting Castle clients with their audiences for 17 years. TheCastleGRP.com. And America's Test Kitchen Live with Christopher Kimball, coming to Sanders Theater at Harvard University October 16th. You can get a lively look at the PBS program America's Test Kitchen. Info at boxoffice.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We assume you've noticed, we hope you've noticed, that all week here at WGBH, we've been talking about football and the NFL with a focus on concussions. The Frontline documentary, League of Denial, the NFL's concussion crisis, kicked off this series of conversations both here on radio and on TV. Listen to this carefully. Here's our colleague, reporter Adam Riley, following up on his thread at a Patriots press conference yesterday.
The long-term impact of concussions in football has been getting a lot of attention lately, including this new Frontline investigation that aired last night. I'm just wondering how much that is something you think about when you're on the field, but also maybe when you're off the field. Is that a topic you ponder, or do you just put it out of your mind?
I don't think about it at all. Yeah. I'm not overly concerned.
I don't think about it at all. Those were the words of Tom Terrific, Tom Brady's star quarterback. He may not be worried about his head, but are you? And much more importantly, did Tom Brady not let down your kid and the parents of that kid, you or whomever, by making the comedy? Did Marjorie and I were talking about this a couple of minutes ago. Marjorie said, well, he was speaking about himself, and he probably was. But even if he's speaking about himself, when the most idolized athlete, not just football player in America, says, hey, I don't worry about concussions, even though they're a crisis in pro football. Marjorie, the message that is sent to young kids who want to be Tom Brady is you shouldn't worry about it either. I think it was grossly irresponsible. Yeah. Good for Adam for asking it. And Tom Brady, almost like a Bill Belichick imitation, he should have said what I think I have to believe he believes is, one, I do think about it, but then he can, and it's a serious concern, and I have great empathy for my former fellow players, the Ted Johnsons, who suffered horrible.
He does not go off the reservation. He's a company guy.
Don't you think it's a problem in this case?
Not as much of a problem as you do.
I think it's huge.
I think that Tom Brady is wants to talk about sports, wants to talk about the next game that's coming up, the strategy. I think when it gets into something that's political, and he obviously views this, or a lot of us would view it as political, because as we know, the NFL was not at all happy about that great frontline documentary that we talked about earlier in the week that basically showed they turned a blind eye to football players getting sicker and sicker and sicker. I just don't see him putting his foot in that.
Well, would you at least agree to the flip that had he put his foot in that, in the middle of that, the positive trickle down to high school and Pop Warner Athletics would have been huge. If Tom Brady himself says, yes, I am concerned about, particularly for the brains, unfully formed brains of young boys and girls, it would have been huge.
Well, I have a different perspective on this. I think we need to look to high schools and educators and teachers and Pop Warner coaches and people that are involved at a young age. I'm not looking to Tom Brady to lead the charge on concussions. I thought Bill Belichick, and we have the sound from him, too.
Yeah, let's give the number first. 877-301-8970. What's your take on Brady's comments? I'm sorry. How about Belichick?
Well, Bill Belichick, I think, gave a much better answer. And we have some sound from him and Adam Riley. And this is great, you know, because usually at these press conferences down at Gillette Stadium, it's all sports stuff. It's all a bunch of sports guys. And there's Adam asking about something that is out of their wheelhouse, generally, this whole concussion issue. So here's Adam. Adam asked Bill Belichick about the concussion thing, and here's Bill Belichick.
I'm not a doctor, and I don't think we want me treating patients. So what we do in the medical department is that's medical procedures that, honestly, I don't know enough to talk about. But I can say this, there's nothing more important to a coach than the health of his team. Without a healthy team, you don't have a team.
You know, every time I hear him, I think, wow, you know, he shows he's got such a fiery spirit there, doesn't he? I mean, he just really, but it's almost a joke what he said. Without the team, you don't have a team. Without a healthy team, you don't have a team. But anyway, he was a little bit more cognizant of the concussion problem. Let's put it
that way. Brady said to Adam Riley he doesn't think about it. By the way, there's no follow up with other reporters, which is unfortunate. And if you think it doesn't matter, I hope you remember a year ago this month, five kids aged 10 to 12, five kids in, I think it's Pop Warner, it is Pop Warner, the Tantasqua Braves, five of them suffered concussions aged 10 to 12. All of them missed school. They were the losers in a 52-0 rout. Southbridge was the team that won. 52-0, five concussions, 10 to 12-year-old kids. I'd be willing to bet, Marjorie, despite what you say, as much as they may respect their coaches, even though in this case they shouldn't respect their coaches at all, I bet you Tom Brady is the person they look to. Tom Brady could have spoken to other 10- and 12-year-old kids yesterday when Adam spoke to him, and he chose not to.
The emails are coming in on your side so far, Jim. Paul from Milton says, Tom's terrific response is an indication that Brady has already been affected by a concussion. And then here's what Christopher says. Maybe Tom Terrific is saying crazy things because he's been wearing a helmet made of Uggs. And, of course, Tom Brady has become a spokesperson for Uggs. You may have seen those pictures of him in those manly-looking Uggs boots. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Part of this for me is, you know, I just don't want to keep looking to even a guy that most people adore, like Tom Brady, is role models for things besides what they do in the football field.
By the way, I couldn't agree with you more, but that's not the reality. I mean, the great line, you remember the commercial from Charles Barkley, who said, I ain't no role model. Well, that'd be nice if they weren't, and it should be their teachers, it should be their parents. Talk about league of denial. It is denial to suggest that the average kid doesn't look to clean Tom Terrific Brady for some guidance, and he didn't give it.
Parents,
in fact, he gave worse than no guidance.
Put up with these ridiculous rules in these Pop Warner leagues where you're practicing much too much. They're much too serious. They think some of these coaches think this is the Patriots.
I know that.
Kids are like, you know, 8, 9, and 10 years old. They're little kids out playing football, which is supposed to be sort of a fun thing. And I forget because it's been a while now for my son, but I think you were practicing 3 days a week when there was school, and 4 days a week in August when there was no school, and you know, it'd be 90 degrees, be out there practicing. It was crazy. And the fact that parents let their kids play in leagues that require that kind of commitment, I think is absolutely insane. Anyway, Norm from Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. I didn't know there was a Pittsburgh. Hi,
Pittsfield?
Norm. Pittsfield, maybe.
Norm, where are you from?
Ask him Air Force Base out here in Bedford, Mass.
Oh, Bedford. Okay. I'm sorry. Hey, Norm. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
What do you think, Norm?
Great show. I think what Tom's comment was directed to himself, and I would put it in the same category as a guy putting on a batting helmet going to home plate to try to hit a pitched ball. It detracts from what you're up there doing. If you think about the consequences of getting hit in the head, you're protected. You just do the best you can, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, yeah, but Norm, before you go away, even if you're right, and you may be, and even if it turns out Marjorie's right and he shouldn't be a role model for kids, Jim McMahon, a fellow quarterback who won a Super Bowl with the Chicago Bears, barely knows where he is. Ted Johnson, a linebacker for the New England Patriots, has had huge problems, as I'm sure you know. So how about at least some empathy shown for his fellow players who have suffered horrible outcomes as a result of hits to the head? I mean, isn't that the least we can expect from? What's that?
Absolutely. You're absolutely spot on. But where was the medical team early on in his career?
Well, you know, at least what Ted Johnson argues, and I surely don't want to speak for him, was he contends that Belichick said, get back in the game. And the basic message, and everybody says this was made, the point was made in the documentary the other night, is in the old days, or maybe the new days, if you didn't get back in, you were going to lose your job. Norm, thank you for the call. By the way, the Southbridge team that beat the Tantasqua Braves 52-0 and inflicted, thanks to their coach allowing the game to go on, 5 concussions in 10 to 12-year-old boys. You know what their motto is? Are you tough enough? 10 to 12-year-old little boy. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Let's go to Tom from Plymouth. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. No, it's good afternoon.
Whatever it is. Hello there, Tom.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah, I just want to say that Tom Brady has a right to a personal opinion. If he were not, somebody that little kids all over the country watch football with their fathers on Sunday afternoons, and they want to be just like Tom Brady. Well, Tom Brady has a responsibility, and he did not fulfill it the other night when he indicated that he didn't think about this at all. If he really believes that, if that's a true statement, I don't know what planet he's living on. Because as you say, you know, you just look at Jim McMahon, who doesn't know where the hell he is.
Former Chicago Bear quarterback, yeah.
Yeah, and he a couple of years ago, I know he was on TV, and he was carrying a picture around of his girlfriend so that he could remember what the heck she looked like.
Yeah, and he's not alone. I mean, there were thousands of former NFL players. This point was made clearly in this Frontline documentary the other night that settled that $750 million deal, which many of us think was not enough money and, frankly, allowed the NFL to not admit any responsibility, which is, I think, a crime. But thank you for your call, Tom.
You know what this reminds me of? The Michael Jordan situation. Remember when
his father
was killed by
his father was killed with a handgun.
A handgun. And the gun control people obviously thought, my goodness, we could have Michael Jordan as a spokesperson mm-hmm. for gun control, and Jordan would have nothing to do with it. It's some of these guys just do not want to get into anything political at all. And I don't know if it's that conscious with Brady or he was just surprised by the question. I don't know.
And by the way, while I would like to see people who are as smart as Tom Brady is and others who are as widely listened to affirmatively make statements, if Adam Riley hadn't asked the question or our colleague hadn't asked the question and he was just silent, then he was just silent. He's got other things to do. But once the question's asked and it is a crisis like it is, again, not just amongst adults who play pro sports, but amongst kids in soccer and hockey and football.
I see it as something else. So I remember going around to other mothers at Pop Warner and saying, do you really want your kids to be practicing 3 nights a week? You know, it takes you a half hour to get the uniform on with all the pads and everything else, and you're sweating. And a lot of the mothers say, no, this is too much because they don't get their homework done. But you know what happens when you go to the coach? Well, those are the Pop Warner rules. So we have to practice X number of times a week. So it's the parents that are doing this with visions of their kids becoming the next Tom Brady are just buying into this whole ridiculous system. I have very little. I mean, I'm sure there are some great Pop Warner coaches out there who aren't saying you can't have any water breaks when it's 90 degrees. But there are a lot of people, like I said, who are just overzealous. And it continues in high school. And it continues in college. It's just become crazy.
Yeah, but one of the major points made in the documentary, which both of us thought was terrific, until, what was it, the early 2000s, the NFL and their, quote, scientific experts were cooking the books until people like Dr. Cantu from BU, Chris Nowinski, who we've had in here, both of them from the Sports Legacy Institute, who have changed the world about concussions, not just for pro players, but for high school kids and below, until they busted open that door, they were saying no problem. And if they're saying no problem, it's not unreasonable to think a parent would say, well, if the NFL scientists say it's no problem, then it probably isn't.
But who said, when we were talking about this the other day, that part of the reason Americans love to watch football is to watch those hits?
Mike Kirk, the one of the producers and the writer of the Frontline documentary.
Okay, so aren't the fathers who are sitting there with their 12-year-old kids reveling in these hits part of the problem? I mean, I think I look at those hits and I wince because I'm kind of a wussy person myself, and maybe because I'm a female, although that's not really a fair remark.
He said 40% of people watching the NFL are women, he said.
But, you know, I mean, this is – is this why you watch? I don't know. Is that why you watch football? To watch people get smashed around like they do?
No, I like the tight pants. I mean, well, I don't know.
Well, there you go.
877-301-8970. Let's take a couple more calls if we can. We're talking about Tom Brady. Can we hear Tom Brady's comment one more time if people just tuned in? Here is the first voice you hear is Adam Riley, who is, as you know, our colleague from WGBH on the TV side. He's occasionally with us. Here he is actually at the Patriots press conference asking this question of Tom Brady, who you'll hear next.
The long-term impact of concussions in football has been getting a lot of attention lately, including this new Frontline investigation that aired last night. I'm just wondering how much that is something you think about when you're on the field, but also maybe when you're off the field. Is that a topic you ponder, or do you just put it out of your mind?
I don't think about it at all. Yeah. I'm not overly concerned.
Okay.
You know what else, though, in his defense? I mean, you can't think about that when you're trying to throw a football and you've got 300-pound linebackers running at you that can, you know, like freight trains. I mean, because you lose your nerve.
Right. So the answer is I don't think about it at all. But you know what I do think about, Adam Riley, or whoever you are, you non-sports reporter? You know what I do think about? All the players that I've been on the field with, all the players who came before
he's
me.
He's not going to do that,
who have suffered. Well, I know, but he should have. Let's go to Patrick.
He's not a politician.
I know, but he's a human being, and humans are suffering
yeah,
who have been in the same locker room with him.
That wants to go out there for a couple more years and face those 300-pound linebackers. He has to think in his head it's not going to happen to him.
Patrick and Attleboro, you're on with Jim and Marjorie, and we're talking about Tom Brady's comments about the concussion crisis in sports. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I guess when I think about it, I think of the entire idea that, well, you know, Tom Brady is an athlete, professional athlete, and it's just his job to play football, and he's not involved with that. It's kind of bunk in a way, because I think once you start making commercials, I don't care if it's a United Way commercial, you always see the NFL players doing that kind of stuff and saying, oh, you know, for the kids and get out and play and be active. And once you start being a spokesperson for an organization, you start taking responsibility for your sport, for your action,
I agree.
You know, for the overall organization. And second of all, I think that, you know, like the segment before, we were talking about politics, right? And the fact that, you know, both parties, they played party lines, and that's what gets people annoyed. So the idea that, well, he's just being a company man, and that's okay, I don't think that is okay. I don't think that's an excuse for not going up against something that's wrong. You know, for not saying, you know, this is wrong. Yeah, it's definitely a concern. And as a leader, as somebody who's probably has a lot of clout in the NFL and could do a lot for the NFL, for him to say, well, I'm just going to play the company line, I don't think that's doing quite enough for the organization. I just don't.
Perfectly.
Those are good points.
Patrick, thanks
those
for the
are
call.
Good points, too. I wasn't aware he's making, I know he's making commercials for clothes. He's big on Uggs. I wasn't aware he was making other commercials.
No, but he's the face of the NFL. If you stopped anybody in America, Marjorie, who watches pro football, even those who don't watch pro football, and said, name one player in the NFL, I would bet more people would say Tom Brady than anybody else by far. He's the face of pro football.
We just have an email from a woman who says there was a football game of fourth graders between Duxbury and another town last week where four children sustained concussions, complete with ambulances.
What level of sports? How old are these kids?
She said fourth graders.
Fourth graders.
Yeah.
How many concussions?
And she's also said, to be fair, Duxbury hosted a concussion dialogue at the senior center, education and changing the outcomes of these football games.
You know, there's some people in this documentary, and again, if you haven't seen it, I'm sure you can find it online, the Frontline documentary, League of Denial, that aired the other night. on PBS who think that under a certain age you shouldn't be playing a football at all because of what it does to a brain that is not yet fully formed. And it's just when you if you have not seen it, and just Google some of the people whose lives have ended, some of the players who've killed themselves. Just do a little bit of research here. The damage is colossal, and it was covered up for years and years by the people who could have done something different about it, namely the NFL.
Well, here's what Keith says. Helmet-to-helmet hits are not allowed anymore. Players are fined big time. You two, meaning Jim and Marjorie, want to legalize drugs. I guess that means marijuana. That does more damage to the brain. Leave the game alone.
Well, fine. Well, there's, I guess, a minority. At least I hope what is a minority point of view. Let's take one more quick one. Betty in Hamilton, you're on with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say Tom Brady is a quarterback, so he doesn't get jumped on and knocked down and headbutted like everyone else who has that happen to them just about every play. So, of course, maybe he's not worried about it. But
yeah.
At the same time,
well, he could, Betty. I mean, lots of times they miss the blocks and then he does get knocked down.
We just talked about Betty. I'm sorry. With all due respect, you're wrong. We just talked about Jim McMahon, who is probably the best living poster boy for the damage done to a human being. One of the great quarterbacks. He was the quarterback of the greatest Chicago Bear team ever that won the Super Bowl. And as that caller said a minute ago, Google him right now. You'll see a guy who barely knows where he is, much less able to lead a normal life. What's that?
I think that's true, but most quarterbacks do not get pummeled like the rest of the team.
Well, Betty, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I do know that in the week six. Well, Troy Aikman, they won a number of Super Bowls for the Dallas Cowboys. I believe that you could probably count double figures the number of current quarterbacks through only 5 weeks of this NFL season who are rumored to have suffered concussions. Maybe it's not as great as other players, but it's up there. Betty, thank you very much for the call.
Okay,
for Adam Riley, by the way, for going there and asking both Belichick and Brady a question that actually matters.
Well, again, he was the only person doing a serious question. Everybody else was obviously there asking about the upcoming game. Okay, when we come back, Christopher Lydon joins us to talk about the unbearable lightness of being. We'll get his take on the new film, Gravity. Stay tuned for that conversation, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. You know, just when the government shut down, the school bus strike happened, the fact that Breaking Bad is over has you feeling that nothing is right with the universe, Christopher Lydon challenges these feelings. Today we found out that his faith in humanity was buoyed, not at a church, by the way, not at the symphony, nor at the theater, but at a Jordan's furniture store. That's where he took it. Well, he'll let him tell you what happened there. Chris Lydon, it's good to see you
there,
again, Chris.
There I was going to see a straight, good public radio kind of movie, you know, Bob Reich's Inequality for All.
Oh, yeah.
And bang, I got diverted to Peabody's. Peabody's Furniture, you know, the bargains and all that
Indeed.
Stuff.
Yeah.
And
what'd
the
you
IMAX,
see?
The IMAX scene. And this movie, Gravity, by a director I really didn't know, Alfonso Cuarón. And you just, I mean, we're all going to go. This is going to be one of the, this is up there with Birth of a Nation, among the historic breakthrough. Mm-hmm. You know, first they had silent films and they had talkies, and now we've got Gravity, and it's a most amazing trip. I mean, 97% critical praise on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, this
wow.
never
Also, I have to say,
happens.
I don't see as many movies as I do trailers, I'm embarrassed to admit. Maybe the most exciting trailers for a movie I have ever seen in my life. Why don't you tell people, for beginners, what the story is for the few that don't know?
It's a very simple story. Two actors on screen the whole time, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. He's a veteran astronaut on his last mission. She's a brand new. She's a medical doctor. She's, you know, she's from Illinois. She's an interesting person, marvelous actress, of course. And their shuttle, or what? I mean, not shuttle. Their machine goes kaflooey. I mean, it's just over. And they are told by Houston, the mission's aborted. You're on your own. So it's two human beings, a guy and a woman, in space, and it's us. And the
and you're not going to tell us the end, by the way. For those who are nervous, we're not going to say the end.
Of course not. Except you will not have nightmares. I find it an amazingly warm, humanistic meditation. But first, the IMAX, and I say, you know, don't go just 3D and don't see it in a regular theater.
Go
for the IMAX experience, because you are, as never before, in my case certainly, you're out there. I have to admit, I resisted the whole Tom Wolfe, Walter Cronkite space adventure. I mean, I skipped that part of the course for 40 years or whatever. I mean, you know, in general, I knew what was roughly what going on. But this, for me, is an introduction to a place I've never been, and both the characters and the place, and it's gorgeous. I mean, the filmmaking is just unbelievable. But and you're ducking shrapnel all the time. The space shrapnel part of the story is that
it's Russian spaceship.
You
or
are well, in the
Russian,
audience with the 3D glasses.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But the Russian Soyuz has cracked up, and the way these things work, as you get to know in space, is that they circle the Earth every hour and a half or whatnot. But the refuse the comes back and whacks you, and you're ducking things all the time. However, I mean, to me, the fascinating question is partly why so many critics or the general line of people is that this is, you know, lost in lonely space. It's cold. It's dark. I didn't find it that way at all. I found it, you know, the characters are both sympathetic human beings. They're lost. They're down. And George Clooney especially has been around the game long enough to know that stuff happens and, oh, my God, this didn't work out. And yet it's full of generosity. He saves her twice, in effect. She has, it turns out, and she tells him her story, she's lost a daughter back home. She's really doubtful about life, about the meaning of it all. And yet the story as they're coping is one of tremendous human resourcefulness and goodness and interest. He asks her, I mean, to me, the beauty of it is that he keeps asking her interesting questions. But you're out there with him and you're thinking, you know, what would I be asking? There's Earth. It's not a high orbit. You know, we're 350 miles, I think, over the Indian Ocean, but you see the Earth and its mystery, but you also, you keep swirling around and seeing not quite the Hubble telescope depth, but you're seeing deep into a totally different world. And so the movie challenges you to ask questions that they're asking. But he
like
says,
what, for example? Well, he says, asked them, by the way, before you tell us what they are, did he ask them because he wanted to know the answer or because he wanted to distract her from the fear of what may befall her?
It's a little of both. He's a kind of garrulous guy with a taste for sort of corny stories before the crisis, things that have happened to him. But I think there is this kind of deep existential probing. I mean, for one thing, it's not a romance. They're both in space, you know, helmets most of the time. You can sort of see most of the time, oh, yeah, that's George Clooney and that's Sandra Bullock. But I think they're asking literally the questions that we would be asking out there. He asks her, what do you miss? What will you miss? What would you miss in Illinois? And she's a rather quiet character, but she's saying, she's wondering about, you know, her prayer life. Is somebody looking after my soul? Is there some other part of me? And that's not a ridiculous question or an intrusive question in any way, in the sense that these earthlings have already reached a completely different stage of life, plateau, vision, existence, and it's thoroughly plausible from there that there's yet another one, that this is, and even the end wouldn't be the end.
Let me invite some phone calls, by the way. 877-301-8970. I intend to see this in the next few days.
We're all long before Chris Lydon,
and now I want to see it more.
One of my daughters called me this morning. You saw Gravity without taking me? What?
Now, hold
if
on.
You have, wait, wait, wait. If you have seen it already, we'd love to hear your take on this. 877-301-8970. And if you're dying to go as I am, I was dying to go because even though I don't like science fiction at all, the trailer is so mesmerizing. When you add this other layer to it, it's a whole other. Is the trailer worth playing, Chelsea? Let's hear a little bit of the trailer, and then Marjorie, you can take over.
Do you copy?
Yes, I copy. I'm detached. I don't know. I don't know. I'm spinning. I can't.
Report your position.
GPS is down. It's down. I can't.
Give me a visual.
I told you nothing. I see nothing.
You have a visual of Explorer.
No.
You have a visual of ISS.
No.
You need to focus. Anything to the sun and the earth. Give me coordinates.
I can't breathe.
You're burning oxygen. You have to sip, not gulp.
Oh, I'm hyperventilating.
Sip, not but gulp.
The trailer is to get you to the theater. That's not at all typical of the movie. And in fact, the acting range, the range of Sandra Bullock's voice is very narrow in this movie. She's meditative after the breathing crisis. She's thinking. She's feeling as deeply
two
as
things.
She can.
I want to ask you two quick things. Number one, I was afraid to go to the IMAX because I thought I'd get sick to my stomach watching this movie in the IMAX. You did not have that experience.
No way.
Okay.
Although I found myself grabbing at frogs in a water scene and holding screwdrivers that were being passed my way, that kind of thing.
Okay, yeah, no, I love that. I love that about the 3D movies. And the second thing is, what I've read about is contrary to that trailer we just heard, that there's a lot of just silence in this movie.
Exactly. This is the point.
Yeah.
This great music,
I
but the silence, which again is drawing you to these long, uncut takes. They're floating around in space, and you're thinking, wow.
Why'd you decide to go, by the way? You were making fun of the typical movie that maybe a public radio type might gravitate to, you being a public radio type yourself. If you had said to me, is Chris Lydon going to divert himself from his path to the Bob Reich film to go to see Gravity, I'd say not a chance in hell. Why'd you go to see it?
Because a friend of mine, young actor, an Albanian that I worked with once in the theater, went to Emerson. He says, everybody at Emerson's talking about this, and you got to see it in the IMAX. I said, let's go.
So were it not for him, you would not have seen it, no likely.
Probably, I wouldn't have seen it this week, and now, I'm so grateful I did.
Did they play that Ground Control to Major Tom song, you know, something's gone wrong? Remember that? Elton John, wasn't
sure.
It? Yeah.
Well, of course, we lose Ground Control.
David Bowie. Thank you,
sorry.
John Parker.
That's not a spoiler. You know, the Ground Control is history. But let me just say, there are so many reasons this is not depressing, including the fact that, you know, one of the first refuges is an abandoned Soyuz Russian spacecraft. I call it the Putin rescue. I mean, we know this this season. And then when that fails, there's a Chinese abandoned satellite just 100 miles away, and they propel themselves with their fire extinguisher, little guidance rockets. But there is a certain one world universal species.
Fire extinguisher, little guidance rockets. Go ahead. That's the term of art, by the way, for those who don't know. But go ahead.
But there's one marvelous scene where Sandra Bullock is sort of at her wit's end. She's on her own, and she's in this Chinese thing. Of course, all the machinery still sort of works, and she's getting radio from China, and there's a Chinese man at the other end with presumably his newborn baby in his arms, and the baby is, you know, wah, 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 wah. And Sandra Bullock finds herself, and I want to think she kind of improvised this. How would you react to, you know, you're in this Chinese space capsule with Chinese lettering marking the various buttons, and there's this voice of a human being from Earth, sort of maybe directed to you. And
come
she,
get me.
She, yeah, well, but Sandra Bullock goes into this. She just and it's, you know, maybe her last contact with Earth. But to me, it's—I don't want to be sentimental about it because Cuaron is not being sentimental, but he is saying Something lives, something connects, something important here.
You know, even though I haven't seen it, the other thing that I know about it that is giving away nothing that I admire, I am a firm believer that 95% of films can say what they have to say in 90 minutes or less, or they shouldn't say it, and it's 90 minutes long, which I think is a tribute to this filmmaker as well.
You know, let me just share something that sounds a little highfalutin, and I don't mean it this way, but I was saying to Chelsea, your producer, this thing called to mind a Chekhov story called Gusev, written, I think, 1890. But I had read it recently, and it's a story of five men who've been serving in the Russian army in, you know, points east near China, and they're coming home, and they realize, they're told rather rudely on the way back, don't you realize this is a death ship? You guys have tuberculosis, and you're going to die. You may even die before you get to Moscow or Petersburg or wherever you're going home to. And sure enough, they start dying. And Gusev himself is put into a burlap sack eventually with weights and tipped overboard. And he ends up floating down through the water in scenes that are really fulfilled in this movie. I want to bet, first thing I'd ever want to ask Alfonso Cuarón is, do you know that story, Gusev? I believe he had to know it. There are so many resonances. But the point is, in the Chekhov story, 1890, Gusev is just kind of floating down among first the pilot fish and then a shark, and you're struck by, he's not seeing it, but Chekhov is seeing these incredible colors and lights coming into the water. It is not a despairing story. It is a story of premature death in a certain way, but in a world filled with beauty, filled with human connection, filled with sort of conscious sadness. And this has that same humanistic voice inside it. This is, to me, the beauty of it. I mean, everybody's going to talk about, you know, the grosses and the business of it and the pressures he was under from, you know, the studios and a lot of changes made in this movie, as well as the unbelievable technical mastery. But to me, what you're going to remember is a kind of heart inside it.
Well, you know, the other plus, I mean, and you've described it so beautifully for someone who hasn't been there, but Marjorie, I think you'd agree with this. Not only can you see this incredibly powerful, beautiful film, you can get a sectional couch while you're there, too. So did you come away with any furniture,
that's
Chris?
Right.
Couldn't get out of there fast enough to go and talk about it.
Let's take a call. Callie, you're on with Chris Lydon on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Callie.
Hey.
Callie. You
saw it. As in our Callie.
Did you see it?
Yes, I did. And I just wanted to support Chris's point about the silence and just note that almost immediately they're disconnected from Houston, which, as you know, is space central. And I was struck by this line, which I assume is official, where they say over and over again, Houston in the blind, and then give their location. Hmm. I left the theater thinking, Houston in the blind, when you are saying something and you think someone can hear you, but you're not certain. And at some point, George Clooney's character says to her, you have to say it even if you don't think they're hearing you. And I just, I don't know what to make of that, but Houston in the Blind has stayed with me since I saw it.
No, speak your heart. I mean, it's a very connected thing, even when you're not sure. I mean, that's praying, isn't it, right?
Yes.
you're praying your heart out, and you're not quite sure whether the big guy is
great.
On the line.
Callie Crossley, thanks for your review.
So
as
we should
well.
All go get to see this, I guess.
It's like taking
here.
Both your description and even the trailer, which you say is not emblematic of what you end up seeing, or at least the bulk of it, is just breathtaking.
Yeah.
By the way, did he write this as well as
he wrote it
make
with his
film?
Son.
He did.
And somebody wants to make a point that, you know, he's close to his son, 26-year-old young man, and they both survived a separation, divorce from the son's mother, et cetera, et cetera. Is this part of the tether? Is this part of the connection and the rescue?
So you're less informed about inequality in America than you would have been otherwise.
No, I went and saw inequality.
Oh, you saw the Bob Rush.
And there were about five people in the theater.
Okay, well,
oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's
some
terrible.
People think Bob is floating through space, but I love him. So
you can't not love him. That movie is puzzling. I don't know whether he's running for something. He's want to run for governor of Massachusetts again. There's a great deal about Bob Reich.
Well, you know, he ran,
of course,
obviously not so long ago, and he's now in what, California? Is he at Berkeley? Wherever he is.
Is at Berkeley.
Let's visit Bob Reich on another day.
That is mere terrestrial politics. This is, you know, gravity is another place.
Look at the smile on his face. Chris Lydon, it's great to see you.
It's
a great
to see you.
I'm so excited. I have to go to the IMAX immediately and see this movie. Okay. Christopher Lydon is with us every Thursday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Thank you very much, Christopher. I'm really psyched.
Otherwise at radioopensource.org.
Which I should have said. Forgive me. At radioopensource.org. When we come back, Karen Miller joins us for fresh from MIT's Tech Conference. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
That's great, Chris. Thanks.
The government shutdown is not just an American story. They're listening in China.
The fact that the government has shut down and the American society has not collapsed is sort of proof to them that the American system is strong and robust.
They're listening in France.
Well, this is pretty bad, actually, you know, all these dysfunctioning elements coming together to have this shutdown.
Listen to the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Metro Rock Climbing Centers in Everett, Newburyport, and opening soon in Burlington, Vermont. You can see the beauty of fall in New England from a whole new viewpoint with their outdoor classes and guiding services. MetroRock.com. And Grogan & Company Fine Art Auctioneers and Appraisers presenting their upcoming fall auction, October 13th and 14th in historic Dedham, Massachusetts. You can view their online catalog at GroganCO.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie has left to see Gravity. No, actually, soon. If you haven't made it to MIT's conference on emerging technologies, fear not, because Karen Miller has. She's the host of Innovation Hub. She's here with us in Studio 3 with a dispatch. Hello there, Karen Miller.
Hi, how's it going?
We're dying to know, what was the most exciting stuff you saw over there at MIT?
There is some fascinating stuff going on. Let me highlight a couple things. One is the change in cities. So we are seeing massive numbers of people all over the world, particularly in China and India, but everywhere, pour into cities. So we have 7 billion people on the planet right now. In about 15 years, we may be looking at 5 billion people living in cities.
Why? Why?
Which is kind of this amazing, because it's where the jobs are, right? I mean, that's where the jobs are, that's where things are happening, and that's where people want to be. And you just see people in mass numbers leaving the countryside and coming into cities. So what are cities going to be? Well, there is some fascinating stuff going on. So one thing is IBM has actually worked on this thing in Rio where there is a command center for cities. So now as cities are built, and there are all these new cities going up, particularly in China, but all over the place, and as cities are rebuilt, they're putting little sensors in bridges, in streets, all over the place so that you can actually sit in this kind of future. It's like Star Trek. It's like sitting on the bridge on Star Trek. You sit in this futuristic command center and you're able to see, you know what? That bridge over there has a lot of stress on it. Remember that bridge that fell down in Minnesota a few years ago?
Yes.
But what if before the bridge fell down, a few months before, you're like, that bridge, clearly, every time things go over it, it is experiencing an unhealthy amount of stress. We need to get out there and fix that bridge before it falls down.
Wow.
That is what is, I mean, that's one of the things that's happening to the future cities.
There are people, because the people who go to this, I assume, like you, know as much about technology and innovation as you do.
Much more.
Are people, no, I'm saying, but are they jaded in the audience? Meaning, if I heard something like that, I'd turn to the person next to me and say, oh my God, can you believe this? Do they do that, or are they sort of?
They might be a little jaded, but some of the stories you hear are so awesome that you hear people in the audience say, oh. So there's this guy, Carlos Ratti, who's the head of the Sensible City Lab at MIT.
Oh, I've heard of him.
Yeah. And they basically just look at what cities are going to be like. How do you reinvent cities? You know, how do you think about these things? And one of the things they wanted to find out, I think a few years ago, was like, where does trash go? Okay, so we've got water bottles in front of us. We drink them. Where the heck do those water bottles go? So they went to Seattle. They tagged hundreds of items of trash, and they – from banana peels to, you know, computers and whatever. And they figure, you know, just like with these little RFID tags, and the question, okay, where do they go? And they tracked them. They went all over the place. They were going to, like, Florida and coming back. And, I mean, who knows? And so he was saying, first of all, that was really inefficient. And then the totally fascinating, unexpected turn of events, which is often how sort of science and tech is, their lab got broken into. And some of their computers, because they had, I guess, left a laptop out and you could see it through the glass and whatever, and somebody broke in.
And they were tagged.
And it was tagged.
I knew that.
The greatest.
So where'd they end
the
up?
The unlucky person who stole something from the Sensible City Lab at MIT. He actually said at the end, the moral of the story is don't steal things from MIT.
Yeah.
So not only, of course, did they know like where this guy lived, they tracked where he drove with this thing. I mean, they knew the roads that he drove through in Boston. And then, this is the greatest thing, they also had sensor cameras on it, which he didn't know. So he's taking pictures of this laptop that, and I don't know if he's trying to sell it on Craigslist or whatever. And the thing's looking back at him. So they had the camera feed, and he wore a shirt with his business
name.
What do
you mean they're playing the camera? Are they playing this
at MIT.
This is great.
They had, yeah. Yeah, so and he was wearing this shirt with the logo of his company on it. So they know all about this guy. Like, they could see the inside of his house, the whole thing. And of course, obviously, the MIT police got him and everything. But it was this fascinating thing of, like, you know, what happens when an object has sensors on it, you know, a tremendous
amount. So theoretically, the natural extension of that is ultimately we get to the point when everything is tagged.
Yeah.
Which means the good news is when something's stolen, you find it. The bad news is every single move you make, forget Edward Snowden's revelations, everything you do every minute of every day is monitorable, if that's a word, by somebody, correct? Is that not the outcome?
Basically, yeah. I mean, and it has this good and this bad. I mean, we've talked about this before. I mean, if you use Easy Pass, people already kind of know where you are. If you use a credit card, you know, I mean, there's a lot of ways of knowing. If you go to the ATM and get money out, every single...
Well, your cell phones, too.
You have a cell phone, right, in your pocket. Every single time you do or have one of those things, people know where you are. Now, the other side of it is it's very helpful to put sensors everywhere so that you know where the traffic is. So, like, before I go home, there's two ways I could go home. And I check to see, you know, where the I check Google Maps. And I think using Google cell phones, they can tell which cell phones are going fast and which ones are going slow. So I know I can save time going on the route home.
Well, it's also good
to know
if the bridge you're about to drive over is going to fall down in a week as opposed to waiting till the legislature. You know, there's one thing we read about. We both wanted to ask you about this.
Yes.
This neuroscientist, Daniela Schiller from Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, she talked about how every time you recall a memory, I don't even know what this means, but it was fascinating. Every time you recall a memory, it changes. What was she talking about? What does that mean?
Well, they've studied memory, and so she basically said it's like something in a box. And I kind of think of it like Play-Doh in a box, right? You make a memory, you shape it and whatever, and it goes in the box. It sort of goes in your brain, and there it is. But every time you go to get it out, it gets you touch it, and it gets a little reshaped. It gets massaged, right? And so it turns out that if you sit down with your spouse or something and say, remember that time 20, 30 years ago? they are going to have a different memory of it than you, because your memory, if you've thought about it a lot, is probably incredibly massaged. People are actually terrible at remembering things in the way that they should.
But your own memory is massaged. Forget your partner, your spouse.
Right.
I mean, she's basically saying your own memory the same.
That's
and
what I'm saying. Every time you take it out of the box, every time you recall that time that you fell in love or something, it changes.
And why
and
is
you
that
put it back in the box.
Why is that important? I find that interesting. But then I said to myself, why do I care? Who cares?
So the implications.
Because you don't know what your life. You don't know.
I know, but
I'm
sure there's
did
a really important
maybe I'm
lesson.
Confusing
in
myself with my neighbor. Who knows?
Oh my gosh, Marjorie. If we have time, I have a great story about confusing your memories with somebody else's. So I'm going to get back to that in a second. But why is this important? Well, a couple of reasons. One is it's really important just in terms of thinking about things in the present. Eyewitness testimony is terrible. And the amount of emphasis that we put on eyewitness testimony. I mean, you've been to law school. I don't know if you did this when you were in law school, but it's like a classic law school sort of game to have somebody run into the law school classroom and like steal a textbook.
You want mine?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Irving Younger was my evidence professor. He wrote the textbook. He was a judge. It was an evidence. Everybody wanted to get into it. It was like 400 people at NYU Law School where I went. He does a whole class and talks about how this is long before the Innocence Project and people thought that eyewitness testimony was not reliable, which a lot of people understand it is now. He did a whole, let's say, 60-minute class, and everybody's shaking their head. All of us are saying, that's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. At which point, he covers his tie. We've all been looking at him for 60 minutes, and he says, okay, what color is my tie? And you know the end of the story.
Nobody,
if there's 300
disagree.
Of us, everybody had a different color. Some people weren't sure. And we'd all been staring at the man intently for 60 or 90 minutes or whatever it was. So it's a variation on the
thing
you were
Well, I love that you said some people weren't sure. So you probably had people saying it's blue and people saying it's red and people saying it's yellow. And they were sure.
Oh, 100%. Of
course
they were.
The only problem is, right, that's mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
You cannot have everybody be right there. And it is amazing how many people are sure in eyewitness testimony and are dead wrong.
Okay, before you go, you whet Marjorie's appetite.
Yes, about
what's the
thinking that you're living your neighbor's life.
Okay, well, I just have to say the second part of that is she's working on people who have, like, post-traumatic memory, you know, stress, and trying to deal with separating out the memory, so they can still remember things from the pain of the experience. Mm. And so helping those people. Okay. There's a great author named Chris Chabris who wrote this great book called The Invisible Gorilla. Check it out. And he tells this wonderful story. He was a postdoc at Harvard. And he was at a party. And this guy's telling this story. And it was about how he was in Legal Seafoods, Kendall Square, which a lot of people know. He's in Legal Seafoods in Kendall Square. And he's with a bunch of friends. And Chris Chabris is sitting there at this party. Listen to this guy tell this story. And the story's about how when the guy was sitting at Legal Seafoods, Patrick Stewart walks in from Star Trek. And he's with this very attractive woman. And they ordered baked Alaska. I mean, at the end of their meal, they ordered baked Alaska, which is very unusual. It's a very unusual dessert, right? Most people don't order baked Alaska. And a bunch of people came out to get his autograph and everything. And people were like, wow, that's amazing. You saw Patrick Stewart. And Chris Chabris taps the guy on the shoulder and says, that didn't happen to you. That happened to me. And the guy says, oh, yeah, I forgot. You're right. He had heard Chris Chabris tell the story somewhere else.
You see, Jim, there's the explanation we've all been searching for.
By the way, Marjorie, you should have been at that conference. By the way, this is totally true.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how many times Marjorie has done the exact same thing
she's
were just discussing.
Your memory?
Mine or somebody else's. And all of a sudden, she or the person says, Marjorie, it wasn't you. Oh.
So, I thought it was.
And what is this?
This
is called
so vividly.
This is MTech. If people want to Google,
yeah,
well, you're going to be talking
technology.
About. Are you talking about it too at some point, or what are you doing with this thing?
I'm just there.
Okay,
living the emerging technology.
What are you doing? It actually sounds for even the likes of me and I think Marjorie. It sounds wildly exciting. I should say. What are you doing tonight and this weekend?
So tonight we're talking about the potential disappearance of half of our jobs. We're also talking about Watson, the IBM computer from Jeopardy. And on Saturday, we've got this fascinating media theorist, Doug Rushkoff, who has this idea called present shock, which essentially says we're so much bombarded by things. So you'll see people at a party, right? And they're sitting there texting, trying to figure out if there's some better party they should be at. right? Because, that's right. I mean, this is sort of the idea of you're sort of shocked by all this information in the present. And I'm going to play a little clip, if we can, of Kim Kardashian. I know, I mean, I try to, I don't know, reduce, elevate the tenor of this show. So anyway, this is Kim Kardashian's sister, dismayed that Kim spends more time Instagramming photos than babysitting during family visits.
You are all about Kim right now. It's not like about coming over and hanging out, taking a picture so you can Instagram or Twitpic it. Like,
wait, so you think I come over here because I want to Instagram a picture of Mason?
I'm just saying that's all you do when you
that
do
is like
time.
So
I'm not
pathetic.
Saying that's why you come here.
She's sitting in for
Jim,
us next
you
week.
You were loving
by the way.
That. You were.
I actually
loving
was
that.
Loving that. To tell the
he
truth,
he loves the Kardashians.
By the way, this present shock—is this a takeoff on the infamous Alvin Toffler future shock?
Yeah. Yes, right. And so his idea is that before the year 2000, everything was sort of geared towards what's going to happen in the year 2000. And now we don't really think about the future. We're sort of shocked by the present. And one of those and one of the symptoms of it, I think is fascinating, is reality television. So reality television has no narrative arc. Like, what is the narrative arc of the Kardashians, right? It's just, it's a Tuesday with the Kardashians.
Exactly.
Right? Or it's a Saturday. And it goes on and on and on. And one of the things he says is, because there's so much information coming at us, that the kinds of stories he used to watch when he was a kid, think of I Dream of Jeannie, think of the Waltons, think of Matlock or Murder, She Wrote. Think about how those narrative arcs work. There's a problem at the beginning of the show, and by the end of the show, it's solved,
that
right?
That is correct.
Right.
Yes.
That is not the way the Kardashians are. That is not also the way, like, Game of Thrones or Mad Men is, right? These things go on basically in perpetuity, either until they're canceled or they, you know, can't think of anything else to do or they can't negotiate with the writers and the stars anymore. But they sort of go on and on and on. There is no narrative arc. We just sort of live in this kind of being bombarded by the present. And he said, you know, part of the reason is because we watch television with the remote control in our hands. And so we're looking for little bits of stories, right? So if you just watch 5 minutes of the Kardashians, it makes sense to you because it doesn't matter what happened before and it doesn't matter what happened after.
I have one last question for you. Can you get me her autograph when you interview her?
Kim Kardashian,
of course.
She is coming up on.
Okay,
no, I'm
fine.
Kidding.
What's
but
on,
I'm working
what's going on,
it.
On with Bruce Jenner. Is he with us or is he no longer? Is he
Bruce Jenner is essentially missing
Kardashians or is he gone? Yeah, what's, he kind of went overboard with the
kind of
went overboard.
I think he's getting it's not good.
By the way, I thought it was Bruce Jenner on a show I saw recently. It was actually Joan Rivers.
I was going to say something.
I beat
like
you
that,
to it. Hey, Karen Miller, great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Sounds like a great conference. MTech over there at MIT.
Kara is with us every Thursday at this time doing her Innovation Hub stuff. And Innovation Hub is on tonight at 9, correct? And Saturday at 10 o'clock.
Got it.
We're going to be talking about present shock.
Exactly.
Okay. Up next, we're going to talk to you about America's obsession with refrigeration and ask you some very important questions about what needs to be refrigerated or doesn't. Do you refrigerate the mayonnaise or don't you? We're going to debate that up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Saxophonist Grace Kelly first appeared live on WGBH radio when she was a teenager. Now, she's on stages around the country and around the world, and she'll be live on WGBH radio again for our next Live from Scholars Jazz Club. I'm jazz host Eric Jackson. I hope you'll check out Grace Kelly tomorrow night at 10 p.m. live from Scholars here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And the Hanover Theater, in partnership with Music Worcester, presenting the Michael Feinstein Trio at the Hanover Theater in Worcester, October 12th at 8 p.m. You can visit thehanovertheater.org for more information.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. There's this article in the Atlantic Monthly. It's entitled The Big Chill. It's actually pretty clever. ask why Americans have such huge refrigerators, from big ice boxes in the cellar to the stainless steel behemoths that people like I have in our kitchens. Is it because we refrigerate foods we don't need to? Is it because it's easier and cheaper to install, I don't know, a big fridge in our kitchen rather than fill up the space with cabinets? Is it because we're gluttons and we're the second most obese nation on the planet? We are at 877-301-8970. We really have two questions, and I cannot tell a lie. I'm much more interested in your answer to the second one. The first one is, why do we have such big refrigerators? And I hadn't thought about it until we read the piece in The Atlantic. But the second thing is something you and I have discussed through the years.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that doesn't need to go into the refrigerator to begin with, which all of us refrigerate? And by the way, you may say to yourself, who cares? Well, actually, you could use smaller refrigerators if that was the case. And second, well, that's the primary thing. And there's a huge amount of space that is taken up by things that most of us think need refrigeration, which we will demonstrate to you in the next couple of minutes. Do not. And if you have something you want to add to that list, something that your neighbor thinks has to go in the fridge, which you know does not, mm-hmm. give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. Do you have a huge refrigerator?
I have a huge refrigerator.
And why is that?
Well, because when you go to buy a refrigerator, let's face it, they're all huge, you know. And I think part of it is you feel prosperous, you know, like you feel like you have a full refrigerator. You feel like you're a good mother. It's full of food, and you get all these options when you know the kids come over with their friends. So you feel like you know you're doing well if your refrigerator is well stocked.
We're Americans. That's sort of the two things.
I like
one,
too much.
It's bad on the energy front.
It saps
a huge amount of energy.
Yep.
And second, I can speak to this firsthand. The more food you have in your refrigerator, you know what the end of that sentence is?
The more you can eat.
The more you eat. And that is not necessarily a wonderful thing.
And you want to have options, too. You know, you don't want to have
good.
Options. When you're hungry and you go to the refrigerator, you want to have kind of a little buffet in there. You can decide, you know, what thing you're going to eat.
Okay, we're going to start down a list for you before we take calls at 877-301-8970 of things that you would not think, that you would think most of you would have to refrigerate, but in fact you don't. And we'll get to the most debatable one in a couple of minutes. The first one on the list, eggs. Most people don't realize that if you turn eggs every single day, did you know this, Marjorie?
I did not.
As long
this.
As you turn them daily, eggs will last perfectly fine outside the refrigerator
Who's
for
doing
10
that,
days.
Jim? You're going to sit down and turn the eggs every morning before you go to work?
Yes, I do. I do.
I don't think so. I want my eggs in the refrigerator.
Because you like them cold or because you're just, that's part of
because
your MO?
Because it makes me nervous to think about
you leave
eggs.
Butter in the, you put butter in the refrigerator? You don't need to. You can leave it for months and months unrefrigerated.
Butter I can see because it is a pain in the neck to butter the bread that's been in the refrigerator because it's too cold. And now
that's not necessary.
Yeah, and we're not supposed to eat butter. Are we supposed to eat butter now? It keeps going in and out. First you're supposed to have it, then you're not supposed to have
it.
Then you find out the trans fats in the margarine, whatever it is. Butter's okay. I'm not going to leave the eggs out. And the big one. Can I mention this,
please?
Not
yet. We'll get to it in a second.
Well, there's a big one that I'm never leaving out.
Can we do a littler one?
I don't care how many stories I read about it.
You know what you never have to refrigerate ever?
What?
Ketchup. Did you know that?
Well, I knew that.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Never.
Never.
877.
Do you refrigerate it?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
877. I like it cold. No, I don't refrigerate. 877-301-8970. Two questions. We only have a few minutes on the table. One, is your refrigerator a behemoth?
Yes.
And if it is, why? And if you have 17 kids, we understand that. Mm-hmm. Short of that. And secondly, what are things that you don't refrigerate that your neighbors don't need to refrigerate either? Let's start in Bridgewater with Jenna. Jenna, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
So your first question was, why do we have such big refrigerators?
Yeah, what's the answer?
Well, my biggest thing with that is the fact that as a, obviously, consumer society in the United States, we have this idea that we need to have all these things at like one time. When you go back like even 50 years, you go to the market to get something when you need it. You don't need to have everything in your house at once. You waste more food than you buy.
Jenna, my view is if I don't have 30 sticks of butter in my refrigerator, I'm not ready for another day. Now, Jenna, what do you not refrigerate that most mere mortals do but don't need to?
What do I not refrigerate? I know a lot of people that refrigerate like bagels and stuff, but I don't do that. Or even like pasta sauce, I don't usually refrigerate that.
Wait, after it's open, pasta sauce you don't refrigerate?
Well, when it's open, yeah, but like people like stock it up in the fridge.
No, we're talking about open kinds of things.
Oh.
Open kinds of things. Is there any? Or you shove everything in there? Is that your bottom line?
Even like juice or whatever, you don't. It doesn't need to be cold. Get an ice cube or something.
Well, it's funny you say that. Once juice is open, forget juice boxes. Once juice is open, it needs to be consumed in a day or two if you leave it out. But you can leave it out and it's perfectly fine. Jenna, thank you so much for the call. You can tell people what the one that is the subject of great debate in this country is, but I do leave it out, and you don't. What is it?
Mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise, that's right.
Not leaving it out.
It can be left
Forget
out.
Forget that.
Add forever, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to leave the mayonnaise out. You know, because also, here's one thing I do not put in the refrigerator is fruit. I don't put the fruit in the refrigerator.
Well, I think most people.
Well, a lot of people do that.
Well, they do because they like it cold, but they don't need it.
Well, some people do. You go to people's house, and my mother-in-law, she always had the apples and the pears.
But did she think they needed to be refrigerated?
I don't know why she had them in there. I was going to get into it with her.
Can I explain?
But she had them in there, and I thought it was very strange.
Let me explain to you or unravel the mayonnaise conundrum before we get back to the coals.
I'm keeping it in the fridge.
You cannot contaminate it with something like a soiled knife or that sort of thing. And you know what the key is? And they make the point in this piece we have
here. Yes, you can.
No, you can't. If you contaminate it, then you got a real problem.
Right.
You have to use only totally clean things. But the key is one of those squeeze bottles. Now, while it costs a little bit more per ounce, essentially the top, it never gets contaminated. You leave it out forever.
I want to put a spoon in the mayonnaise and get a big dollop of it to put
Fine,
in my egg
salad.
And just
wash the spoon afterwards.
And tuna fish and all that kind of stuff. No, I'm going to. You know what else? You know what else they say you can't put in the refrigerator?
You can. You don't have to. What?
Kraft cheese singles. Yeah. Now, most of us don't eat Kraft cheese singles unless we have little kids. We're going to make grilled cheese sandwiches. You probably shouldn't even make them because it's not very good stuff. But you're going to leave the Kraft cheese singles sitting around
Margaret,
in the house?
Margaret, I haven't told you this before. I got a pack of Kraft cheese singles for my 20th birthday. I've been carrying them around all these years. I had a grilled cheese with those very same Kraft singles just last week.
And you know what else? I just didn't try this because Jim is always eating the food that I bring in.
Yes, I am.
Now, this is a thing. It's a little weird for me, but I baked goods, you know, muffins, bread, bagels, I want them really fresh. I hate it.
You refrigerate them?
I put them in the freezer.
Ruins them.
I put them in the freezer so they'll be really fresh. And when you eat half my muffin in the morning, you never close it up in the
correct
cellophane, so it always gets stale.
Fine.
And I really wish you'd stop doing that, Jim.
Well, I'm sorry. That's not going to happen anytime soon. I'm trying to be as candid with you as I possibly can be. Rick, you're
in
Newton.
Do you want to have stale muffins?
Rick, you're in Newton. Eat it fast. You won't have to worry about it. Rick and Newton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Rick.
Hiya. Well,
hey.
So I stick everything in the refrigerator.
Yeah, well, you're a typical
butter,
American.
Apples. But it's not the refrigerator, though. It's not about refrigeration.
What is it?
It's about this. It's a monument in the refrigerator. I mean, the thing is ridiculously huge. It's got to be full all the time.
It does.
Refrigeration.
It's not.
I mean, I'm definitely putting my butter in there for the rest of my life. I'm putting everything I can in that refrigerator, but it's not about refrigeration.
You mean even if I convince you that mayonnaise doesn't have to go in, it would make no difference to you, correct?
You know, it's kind of like, I want to go to the best hospital, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's stainless steel, it's clean.
Yes.
Section right there.
Exactly.
That's what I got in my refrigerator. I'm going to use it. Hey, you want to come in and see my refrigerator? We have a dinner party. Think about this. People come in, they say, oh my God, what a beautiful refrigerator.
Yeah. You're a proud man, Rick. We can tell in your voice. It's a beautiful thing. Thank you. Thank you
well,
very much for the
really
call.
Depressing when you go, if you know, young men, like in their 20s, young bachelors, you go into their refrigerator.
Beer.
And what do you see? You see beer and like a moldy piece of cheese.
Cream cheese and bagel.
I mean, how depressing is that? Yeah. It's very upsetting.
You know what they need?
You
know what the solution to that
good.
Is? Kraft singles. Let's go to Tracy in the car. You're next with Jim and Marjorie, Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Tracy.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I just wanted to talk about, you know, I have a regular size apartment size refrigerator in my home. That's... You don't need a huge refrigerator. When you go to Europe, people don't have huge refrigerators with bread and fruit and other kinds of things in them. They stop on the way home and buy fruit fresh. They stop on the way home and get a small bread. That's the way to eat instead of loading your refrigerator with, whether it's perishable or not, the stuff that you don't really need that ends up going bad, especially in this economy.
Well, or it goes in you, which it doesn't need to. Tracy, before you go away, we're going to play for you since you brought up Europe. This is a French advertising expert perfectly breaking down how America compares to other countries when it comes to how we store and treat our food, the point you were making. Here it is.
In France, the cheese is alive. You never put the cheese in the refrigerator because you don't put your cat in the refrigerator. It's the same, it's alive. If I know that in America the cheese is dead, and I've been studying cheese in almost 50 states in America, I can tell you the cheese is dead everywhere. Then I have to put that up front. I have to say this cheese is safe, is pasteurized, is wrapped up in plastic. I know the plastic is a body bag because you can put it in the fridge. I know the fridge is the morgue. That's where you put the dead bodies. Yeah? And so once you know that.
So, Tracy, did he not capture the essence of what you were describing? Oh, Tracy is gone. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. When you were talking about the Kraft cheese singles?
Yeah.
Yes.
Those will outlive cockroaches. You can't kill a Kraft cheese single.
That's true.
You put it in the fridge.
The shelf life of nuclear waste. That is correct. Tracy, thank you for the call. It's very sad that we're out of time.
It is sad we're out of time.
Someday soon
coffee.
We'll continue this.
They say coffee you're not supposed to put in the refrigerator.
No, you freeze. You do not. You freeze coffee.
I thought
you're
supposed to leave it in a cool, dry place in a glass
that's
container.
That's a cool, dry place. One thing I know is coffee, Marjorie.
Okay, Jim.
This is so sad. I was just getting gone on the
about
mayonnaise
this
thing.
All day long. Don't put batteries in the refrigerator either. Okay, thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to continue our conversation about pit bulls with the MSPCA's Mike Kiley. Emily Rooney is also with us with her great list of not complaints, but observations.
The reason we're doing the pit bull thing, we should say, we rarely do something again. We did it 2 days ago. Record response.
Yes.
I had a pit bull on television with me last night. Record response. People care about pit bulls.
People are into pit bulls. It's a big subject. That's absolutely true. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio, Boston Public Radio. Thank you again for listening to us. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy. Follow us at Jim Browdy, at Marjorie Egan, and at BOS Public Radio. Thanks so much for being here. See you tomorrow noon. Bye.